Hi, everybody. My name is Tammy Pearsall, and I'm an alcoholic. And wow, I feel like a T-ball player in the major leagues up here. I'd like to start by thanking Shirelli for asking me to come out and speak today. I'd like to thank the committee for agreeing to it. I'd like to thank all the people who served for the hospitality and the beautiful basket in our room. I'd like to say that Patrick got into it and ate it all, but I got into it last night. I'm just really honored and privileged to be here. To be honest with you, I'm probably the baby of the group. I have 16 years of sobriety, actually well into my 17th year. And it's kind of tough to talk in front of all the mentors that I have followed speaking the past 16 years of my life. And many of you saw me come in, and many of you are always willing to share with me what I was like when I came in. I didn't come in quietly. I was kind of like Pooh Bear sliding into Honey. But I'm really grateful to be here today. You know, really quickly, I just want to pay respect to my stepfather. He passed away a week ago, I'm sorry. And so it's my first Father's Day without my dad. And he was like the only father I ever had. And he was a real man of character. And I called my mom this morning, who's brokenhearted because she's lost the love of her life. And the morning that my dad was dying, I called my sponsor and I said, you know, he's going. And she said, Tammy, you get up, you go to your chest of drawers, you pull out your big girl panties, and you go and you help your mother bury her beloved husband. And I was able to do that. And she told me, you can be sad, but you're not depressed. And you can feel anxious, but you don't freak out. And you've taught me how to handle things differently here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm grateful for that. And I said, Mom, I'm sad I'm not with you today on Father's Day. And she said, Tammy, you're exactly where he would want you to be. My parents don't understand Alcoholics Anonymous. They're not alcoholic, but they're amazed at what you people have done with my life. So I'd like to wish all the other fathers out there a happy Father's Day. And, you know, when people come and ask you to come out and speak, you go to somehow carry some type of a message. And one more time, at yet another convention, the message has been carried to me by all the wonderful speakers. And let's give all the speakers a round of applause. Okay, I'd like to welcome our new friends that stood with under a year of sobriety to Alcoholics Anonymous and tell you what they told me 17 years ago, when I came crawling through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous after losing the only two things I had ever loved up to that point in my life, my 5-year-old son and my 6-year-old daughter. Because a liquid called vodka, a liquid that is no more or less innocuous looking than the water in this glass, was so powerful, it became more powerful than a love a mother had for her own two children. And I had drank away my two children. And I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and they didn't tell me, get a sponsor, work the steps, go to meetings, buy a book. They told me that I never had to drink alcohol again if I didn't want to. And even if I did want to, you told me that you could show me a way of life that I could live without drinking alcohol. And I've come to understand in the 16 years that I've been here that that is the best promise you can give a drinking or a sober alcoholic, because we all walk through hard times in sobriety. And Alcoholics Anonymous can promise you a way of life that you don't ever have to drink alcohol again. And I think we get away from that message a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's the best promise you can give a drinking or a sober alcoholic. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was living in a 4,000-square-foot home with 2 cars in the garage paid for on a 1/2-acre land with a full-time maid. And my husband and kids were living in a 1-bedroom hotel room. That's apparently how bad my drinking had become for them. I had my first drink. Sorry, I have a bad throat. Hold on. But I'm drinking out of a glass, so I'm moving up these days. I had my first drink when I was 13, and I've come to understand after reading the book Alcoholics Anonymous that I had an abnormal reaction to alcohol the very first time I ever swallowed it. But I didn't understand that at 13 years old because I didn't know what an alcoholic was. My dad was having a business party, and my job as his little 13-year-old daughter was to carry these trays with these flutes of champagne to all his business guests. And I was so looking forward to this night. I didn't get a lot of attention from my father. In fact, and this is my biological father, I was scared to death of him. And I so wanted to please him and show him that he had made a right decision in deciding that I was old enough to be able to handle this. And my sister, who was exactly a year older than I, and I had these matching little dresses, and we'd had our nails done, and our hair was up. And I just felt so grown up. And about a half an hour before the party started, the valet parking was downstairs, and this tall guy came in with brown skin and a cummerbund and a bow tie, and he was the hired bartender. And he went up to my dad's bar, and he's popping these champagne bottles, and steam is coming out the top, and there are these long, elegant flute glasses, and he's tipping them sideways and pouring in the champagne, and the bubbles are going from the bottom up to the top. And that sister that was a year older than I was, I always had a problem with her because she never got those potential lectures. Apparently, she had potential. She knew where it was. She knew how to access it. I apparently had that potential, too. But for whatever reason, I didn't know where it was, and I never knew how to access it. So I remember her asking the bartender, "What does champagne taste like?" And he said, "Well, it's kind of sweet. It's kind of dry. It tickles your nose when you swallow it." So she took a little sip, and she sputtered the whole thing up. And the bartender laughed, and I saw my opportunity. And I always used to try to play one-upsmanship on that sister any chance I got, and I sure couldn't do it in other areas. So I took my hand, and I grabbed that flute glass, and I downed one of those as quickly as I could. And my sister's eyes dropped open, and the bartender's eyes and his jaw dropped. And now I've got an audience, and like any good buddy in Alki, I took two hands, took two more flute glasses, and I went bang, bang. And I was angrily put into my bedroom within 20 minutes by that father that I had so wanted to please, because I was slurring my words and laughing inappropriately, and he put me into my bedroom, and I had my first blackout, and I puked that night. I'm a puking drunk. That's not feminine, but that is my story. I'm the type that'll puke like chunks of food onto your tie or your shoes. And there has never been a time, ever, that I have swallowed beverage alcohol and I have not puked. That's how physically allergic I am to alcohol. But I didn't understand that because I didn't know what an alcoholic was. I ran away from home at age 15 to make a real long, complicated story short. Trust me, if you were a girl and you had a budding teenage body, you weren't safe at home with my father. I'd already been put in two foster homes prior to the age of 15 because of the illicit nature of the relationship my father had with his two teenage daughters. And my sister had run away from home when she was 15, so I was left home alone. And my mom had remarried to my stepfather, who was the most wonderful man, but of course I didn't understand that. I was full of rage. I was full of anger. I was a wild, chaotic teenager. And I share this for one reason only, because like Clancy so eloquently shared yesterday, I thought because of what happened in my childhood, my case was different, that I had a right to drink, and I wore that childhood like a badge, you know, that if you had a father like I did and you lived in foster homes like I did, you'd drink too. So I ran away from home, and I moved in with my sister who had run away from home a year earlier because I faced going into a foster home for the first time without my sister, and I didn't want to go. Now, I dropped out of high school, and we have no parent or adult supervision, and we're living in a one-bedroom studio apartment, and that lasted all of about 4 months. That was like the blind leading the blind. And then I became a 15-year-old runaway, and I lived the way most 15-year-old runaway girls live. I was young. I was fun. I was cute. I was worldly, and I was willing to pay a price. And sadly to say, there were a whole lot of older men out there that were willing to take in a 15-year-old girl and have her pay a price that no 15-year-old girl should ever pay. And I lived like that for a long time, and I remember I was living with a 42-year-old man, and I'm 15 years old. And we walked into the post office one day, and on the wall in the post office was a sign advertising the GED exam. And for those of you that aren't familiar, the GED exam is a battery of 5 tests that you can take, and if you pass them, it's equivalent to having your high school diploma. So he and I used to play Jeopardy at night. He's 42 and I'm 15, but I used to always beat him in Jeopardy. And so, you know, he's the flavor of the month, and at this time I have no principles or thoughts of my own. I just kind of go along with whatever the flavor of the month wants me to do. And he looks and he says, "You know, Tammy, you're a pretty smart little kid. You should take that GED exam and see if you can pass." So I'm like, okay. So I took the form. You know, I didn't care, and I filled it out. But one more time, I want to impress him. And 6 weeks later, I'm taking the GED exam at a local high school out where I live in the San Fernando Valley. 4 weeks after that, I get news in the mail that I had passed the GED exam and I had just turned 16 years old. About a week after that, a woman from the Daily News out where I live in the San Fernando Valley called me, and they wanted to do an editorial on what a 16-year-old who just got her GED exam was going to do. Now, I don't know if this is true. The GED exam has been around since after World War II, but I believe they had just lowered the age in the state of California from taking it from 18 to 16, so I may have been one of the first people to have passed it at that age, hence their interest in me. So I tell this girl, sure, you can come out, and she comes to my apartment, and I'm 16 years old, you know, and I've got like a strobe light and a fish tank and beads hanging. And I'm living with a 42-year-old man. And, you know, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, you old-timers, by the way, young people in Alcoholics Anonymous, there's some universal truths here that they don't mention in the book. And one of them is, if you don't like the old-timers, don't worry about it. You'll never be one. And, and I learned that the hard way. And I came in, and those crusty old goats used to say to me, you know, kid, you don't have a bad little message from the podium, but it's kind of hard to decipher with all your swearing and your cussing. And they asked me to clean up my language. And I remember sitting in my sober arrogance, you know, what the F does that have to do with sobriety? But, you know, as I look back over my story, and they talk about that in the book, that we need to look over our drinking history. And as I look back over my story, when that girl came in to interview me, she was about 25 years old. She had just graduated college. This was her first job as a journalist, and she was beautiful. She had no makeup on. She had her hair parted on the side. She was wearing a little business suit, and she was probably only 2 or 3 years older than my little daughter is today. I have a 22-year-old daughter, and she was absolutely beautiful. And I remember being painfully aware that a college-educated, dignified, sophisticated girl like her is going to want nothing to do with a pass-around little tart, you know, sleaze bag like me. And I remember looking down and feeling that shame that I always felt around those kind of ladies. And that girl looked me in the eye, and she said, Tammy, you must be really smart to have passed the GED exam and never attended a day in high school. Are you going to go on to community college? Now, I don't come from college-educated kind of folks, so we don't have that kind of discussion in our home. And I said, what's community college? And she gave me her card, and she took me down to Pierce College, this little 25-year-old beautiful girl. And she didn't judge the way I dressed, and she didn't judge the way I acted and spoke. And she helped me enroll in Pierce College for $32 a unit, and I was only 16 years old. And the fact that this feminine, sophisticated girl took an interest in me, I wanted to please her, and so I stayed at that college, and I made the dean's list all 4 semesters. And now I understand why you old-timers asked me to dress like a lady and to clean up my language here on the podium, because the little pass-around Sue's come into my home group, and I walk right next to them, and I look them right in the eye, and I say, welcome home, because that's what you people did for me. So I go to Pierce College, and, you know, there's a lot of one-upsmanship that's played here from the podium. And when I came in, a lot of women in particular, because I paid attention to the women, would say, I haven't had a sober breath in 20 years prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, or I drank 24/7 around the clock. And I'd sit in the back of the room and say, then I must not be an alcoholic. Because, see, I can swear off of alcohol. And it wasn't until those crusty old-timers got my nose in that book, and it says that we have brief intervals of recovery, followed always by yet a worse relapse. But I didn't understand that when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, because I didn't know what an alcoholic was. But I definitely have swearing off periods, and my swearing off, I don't know what yours look like, but mine is always with a solemn oath that I am never going to drink again. This is insane. And I usually take all my alcohol bottles and I find some dumpster wherever I'm living and go through some ritual of, you know, throwing it high up in the air and bam, hearing them crash in the dumpster. Like this is some way of saluting and saying goodbye to the enemy. And then, I don't know, this tends to run more with the women, but I'd go down to, like, the local drugstore, and I'd buy conditioner and nail polish, and I'd shave my legs and paint my toenails and condition my hair. And then I used to go back when I got sober, Mrs. Gooch's was still around, and I'd go to the local health food store, and I'm living off a diet of vodka, but I go to Mrs. Gooch's, and I drop $100 on brown rice and yogurt for breakfast. And then I joined the local health club, and I start working out, and at this point I was enrolled in Pierce College. So when this girl showed some interest in me, I was determined to swear off alcohol one more time. and start to clean up my act. So I conditioned my hair, painted my toenails, shaved my legs, signed up for 17 units, played on their tennis team, worked out at the local health club, and I made the dean's list. I had a 4.0 for four semesters there, and I was absolutely nuts. But when I graduated Pierce College at 18 years old, I earned what's called the Chancellor's Award. And that's an award they give to students that demonstrate some type of academic excellence. And that Chancellor's Award entitled me to go to any university, state university in the state of California, for the next 2 years so I could finish up and get a bachelor's degree. And they were going to pay my housing, my tuition, and my books. And guess what I did, guys? Of course. I quit. Because I inherently knew at 18 years old that there was no way I could sustain being responsible another 2 years and working out every day and eating brown rice and yogurt for breakfast and studying and having to make straight A's. I knew I couldn't do it. I knew it. Because I didn't understand the mental obsession. I didn't understand that I have to arrange my life so that eventually I can drink. And if I had gone 2 more years to college, I'd then have something called a bachelor's degree. And if I had a bachelor's degree, you people would expect me to get that one thing that every alcoholic hates to get, a J-O-B. And it's, and see, I lose custody of my kids, and I lose husbands, and I lose opportunities. We have special skills, aptitudes, and abilities. It tells us that in the book. We can build a bright outlook for ourselves and for our families, and then we pull the whole thing down over our head with a senseless series of sprees. And they described exactly what I was doing in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, but again, I didn't understand that at 18 years old because I didn't know what an alcoholic was. So for the next 3 years, I do what I do best, which is bad relationships and drinking. And my drinking had certainly taken much more daily proportions, let's just say that. And again, I'm living with another man in the chaotic, crazy relationship. And next door to me and the man I was living with was this doctor. His name was Rick. Many of you know my ex-husband, Rick. And one wall separated my boyfriend and my apartment from Rick's apartment. And Rick was an obstetrician. He delivered babies for a living. And poor old Rick met me in a swearing-off period. And he didn't know that. And this was pre-Al-Anon for him. And I was athletic, academic Tammy by day. One more time, I swore off, and now I've signed up at Cal State University Northridge, and I'm taking 17 units, and I'm running 10Ks every day, and I'm working out at the local health gym, and I'm conditioning my hair, and I'm painting my toenails. And Rick meets me, and I'm taking classes like microbiology and physics, and they were a lot of the classes that Rick had taken when he had gone to medical school. So he had every Wednesday off, and he'd help me with my homework down by the pool. And he took a real interest in me because I was athletic, I was academic, he was single, but I was living with this other guy, a minor difficulty there. And but again, my brief intervals of recovery are shorter and shorter, and I start going home and drinking kamikazes with the boyfriend, and we get in those knockdown, drag-out fights, you know, slapping each other, pulling each other's hair, taking each other's inventory. And my next-door neighbor, Rick, was always the one that would call the cops when my boyfriend and I would get into those, like, you know, the dance of death that we know how to do when we're drinking. And I remember the cops would come, and my boyfriend would open the door, and Rick would be standing behind the cops saying, "Is Tammy okay? Is Tammy okay?" And my boyfriend would get rid of the cops and get rid of that nosy neighbor, Rick. And then we'd go upstairs and do those all-night passionate makeups. You know, the way we know how to do. We're killing each other at 7 o'clock at night, pulling each other's hair, beating each other up. After the cops are gone, it's like, "Oh, baby, don't ever leave me. You're my soulmate." Because we're nuts. And I woke up the next morning. She identifies, I can tell. I woke up the next morning. And it tells us in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, that after a while, a drinking alcoholic can no longer separate the true from the false. That after a while, the only thing an alcoholic comes to understand is their drinking life. And that had certainly happened to me. Because the next morning I woke up, I took a little liquid makeup, I covered up the black eyes, the bruises, and the choke marks. I put my backpack on my back. I went off to Cal State University Northridge like there was nothing wrong with this picture. 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I come home from school. I'd been beaten up the night before by the boyfriend, hadn't had any sleep because we made up all night. I'd been drinking the night before, and I'm in the underground parking of my apartment complex walking toward the elevator. And if you identify with this, you are probably an alcoholic. I'm walking toward the elevator. I haven't seen the vodka, I haven't smelled the vodka, and I haven't tasted it. But all of a sudden, my mind says that all I have to do is get in that elevator, go up 3 flights of stairs, put my key in the first door, open up that cabinet, and that vodka's waiting for me, and I'm already feeling relief. And I'm walking a little more relaxed, and my jaw's starting to relax, and I know liquid relief is on its way. And I'm going, and the elevator starts to open, and all of a sudden, that neighbor Rick, who'd called the cops the night before, says, "Tammy, hold the elevator." Now, the last darn thing I want to do is get stuck in the elevator without my liquid confidence. And I'm like pushing the closed door button, and the next thing I know, his hand wedges between the door, and I am stuck in the elevator without any liquid confidence. And prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I used to use a tremendous amount of cussing or brash, kind of tough street girl attitude, or a lot of inappropriate sexual humor to try to put a wall between me and you so you'd always be on the defense with me, so you could never just look me in the eye and have an intimate relationship with me. So I'm in the elevator, and Rick says, "Tammy, can I ask you a question?" I'm like, "Yeah, what the F do you want to know?" And then he says, "No, I'm really serious, Tammy," and I felt him looking at me. So then I do the seductress, because I have a bag of tricks, and I'm playing with his tie, and I'm like, "What is it you want, Rick?" And he took my shoulders. He took my shoulders, and he held me at arm's distance, and he took my chin, and he lifted it up so I couldn't wiggle away. And he looked right down into my eyes. Those beautiful brown eyes of his. And he said, "My God, Tammy, what is it about you that makes you feel that you deserve to live like this?" And I felt that he looked right down into my soul. And for whatever reason, I got off the elevator that day and I went into Rick's apartment. And there was no seductress and there was no cussing, tough little brash street kid. And I just told him the truth about me. I told him where I came from. I told him about my dad. And I told him the cry of every drinking alcoholic. One day I'm going to get an education. And one day I'm going to have my own job. And one day I'm not going to live with these abusive men. And one day and one day and one day. Because the cry of every drinking alcoholic is, "I know my life is crazy. But one day, miraculously, poof, it's just going to all come to fruition and be okay." And for some reason, I believe that. I believe that's what keeps us going until we make it here, if we're lucky enough to make it here. And I broke down, and I cried like the broken little girl that I really was. And I let him hold me, and I remember my head on his chest, and I could feel him breathing, and I sobbed like a broken little girl. And he just stroked my hair. And I left his apartment that night and went back to the apartment with a guy that I was living with. And I remember I didn't drink that night. But I woke up the next morning, and I felt that fear that they talk about in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. That fear that comes in 100 different forms. That fear that guides an alcoholic's actions, an alcoholic's thoughts, and an alcoholic's behavior. And I did the only thing an alcoholic knows how to do when they feel that fear. And they don't have a God that they can pray to for strength. And they don't have friends like Bob and Marilyn Lemke that they could just call up and talk those dumb fears through with. And I went to the bottle and I started drinking. And I came up with a plan. You know, my old-timer... my old-timer Don always says, "Tammy, every alcoholic has a plan. Doesn't mean it's a good plan, but it's a plan." And in my drunken stupor that morning, I decided that I used to take care of that guy Rick's cat when he used to travel to medical conventions and his plants. And I somehow decided that I needed to get him between the sheets and seduce his real thoughts about me and the reality and the truth that he saw about me out of his head, because Rick had seen a truth about me that I wasn't able to face yet. And so I took all the stuff with the boyfriend that I lived with, and I moved them right next door to Rick's apartment that day. And I made dinner and had it waiting on the table with flowers. And I became his new live-in girlfriend. And for those of you that know Rick, you'll understand, Rick married me 3 weeks later. And hence he later qualified for Al-Anon. And I'm not going to go into all the devastating things that happened the next 7 years of that marriage, but what I will tell you is that I punished Rick for all the things that my dad and those men on the streets had done. And because he was pre-Al-Anon, he sadly took the abuse, and I damn near destroyed his soul. I darn near destroyed his soul. And that marriage produced 2 children, and today I have a beautiful 22-year-old daughter, Chelsea. Sorry, I'm losing my voice. The crying doesn't help. I'll try to control it. I have a beautiful 22-year-old daughter, Chelsea, and a 21-year-old son, and through the grace of God, for whatever reason, I became so physically sick when I was pregnant with those two children that I couldn't stand the smell of perfume, I couldn't stand the taste of coffee, and I couldn't stand the taste of alcohol. And I went 9 months pregnant with my daughter, and 6 weeks after I gave birth to her, my breast milk started to dry up, and I went to my local doctor. My ex-husband always hates me sharing this because he's an OBGYN, and found out 6 weeks after I gave birth to my daughter that I was pregnant again with my son. And you're supposed to, like, wait 8 weeks. And I went another 9 months without picking up a drink. But I remember one morning, I heard on their nursery monitor, I was in my bed, and I heard my son singing in his crib. And I went into their room, and I looked up, and there was my brand-new little son and my one-year-old daughter. And it was like I was so painfully aware that somehow in the last 18 months, I had brought two living human beings into the world, and they were looking at me for something. And I was so painfully aware that I was a completely dependent human being, and I had nothing to give those little kids. And one more time, I did the only thing an alcoholic knows how to do when they feel that fear. And I went down to the liquor store, and I bought a bottle of vodka, and I kept it underneath my bathroom counter. And every morning, I would wake up, go into my bathroom, excuse me, and lock the door. And I'd take a toothbrush with toothpaste, and I'd put the toothpaste down on the toothbrush and lay that down on the counter. And I had this long blonde hair, and the barf particles that bounce off the toilet water would get in my hair, so I wrapped my hair up in a shower cap. And I actually had two. I had like a plastic Naugahyde one for the linen, for the winter, and then I had like a lighter linen one for the summer. And so I would arm myself with my drinking ware and my toothbrush. Then I would take my nose, and I'd plug my nose with my fingers and uncap the vodka, because God forbid I smelt the vodka, I would start to gag and retch before I could keep it down long enough to take effect. Then I'd swig as much of that vodka down as I could. Then I'd have to recap the bottle before I smelled it. Then I'd have to take the toothbrush with the toothpaste and brush my teeth and brush my tongue, because God forbid if I tasted it too quickly, I'd puke it up before it could take effect. Then I'd slowly release my fingers and just pray that that vodka would stay down long enough to heat up my chest and give me that goofy feeling in my head. And every single morning, my 2- and 3-year-old, Mommy, Mommy, are you done throwing up yet? And if that isn't insane, I don't know what is. And to give you some idea of the effect that alcohol had on me, a couple of years of this went by, and then my pre-Al-Anon husband decided to hire a full-time housekeeper to stay home and watch me because I had this affinity for getting drunk and then getting behind the wheel of a car. And I already had a felony DUI. And then he took our two small children out to full-time daycare. Now, he delivered babies all night long, see office patients all day. I don't go to school. I don't work. I have a full-time maid taking care of me, and someone else is raising my kids, and we have a lot of money. And that's suicide for an alcoholic. And I start drinking, double-fisted drinking, and I remember one day in particular, I had somehow gotten myself good and tanked and got on the 2-story roof of the house that we live in Chatsworth. And my husband came home in the late afternoon with the two kids in the car, and there's Mom. You know, they pulled up in our cul-de-sac, and there I am on the roof, you know, wild and drunk. And he parks the car in the garage and walks out of the garage, and he and the kids, he's got my 2- and 3-year-old on either side of them, and they're all looking up at me, and it's kind of a low roof. And I remember just jumping off the roof onto his head and digging my nails in his head, and he's spinning around with me on his back. The two children are screaming. I live in a cul-de-sac. All my neighbors are coming out. And he reached up to grab me to get me off of him, and his fist knocked me really hard on the side of my eye. And I waited till the next morning to sober up. And I went into the Devonshire Police Division the next morning with a huge black eye and a hematoma, and I filed felony battery charges on my husband for something he didn't do. That's what I do when I drink alcohol. I am not here to socialize, meet men, play games, and party. I destroy people's lives. I destroy people's careers. My husband was an air flight surgeon in Vietnam. He went to school for 15 years to become a doctor, and I had those doctors, those detectives, walk in his office on a Monday morning with a waiting room full of women patients that had been going to him for 18 years before he married my drunken butt. And they slapped handcuffs on my husband and took him off to jail in front of his patients and his staff for something he didn't even do. And that was the only sober parent that Chelsea and Alex had. And that's the extent of the selfishness and the self-centeredness and the rage and the anger that I have when I drink alcohol. It was very shortly after he spent that night in jail that my husband met at that time what I believe to be a horrible group of people called Al-Anon. And I'm an alcoholic that will never, ever tell Al-Anon jokes because they took away my husband. Or they took away my greatest enabler, and they gave me back a husband, and they gave my children back a father. But God, I hated you Al-Anons while I was drinking. Now, I'm a woman that sleeps around town. I don't take care of my kids. I don't have an education, and I'm always looking for an edge. And Al-Anon is still predominantly women. So can you imagine the threat that I felt when my husband is going and hanging out with these women who take care of their children, who love their families, who work, who support their families? And I felt that fear that they talk about in the book. And actually, Ellen, it's really good to see you. You're one of my favorite Al-Anon ladies, and you were always so kind to my husband and I. And I'll never be able to thank you for that. Anyway, he starts going to these Al-Anon meetings, and I think I called them the, oh, are you going to go to your Let's All Feel Sorry for Dr. Rick Harum meetings? And so off he goes, and I'll never forget he came home after going to Al-Anon for a while. And I'm just drinking around the clock now because I just really don't care anymore. And he said, Tammy, you can go to a hell in a handbasket if you want to, but you're no longer taking the kids and I with you. And I saw something in his eyes. And I knew that you Al-Anons were giving him the strength and the backbone that he needed to stand up to the insidious alcoholism that was affecting his wife. And I felt that fear. And I went down to the liquor store, and I bought a big bottle of vodka, and I plugged my nose. I downed it as much as I could. I puked it all up in a brown paper bag, threw the bag out on the road. God help the guy who found that, right? And I get up on the 118 freeway out where I live in Chatsworth, and the alcohol started to take effect. And again, this tends to run more with the women, but I'm one of those obnoxious phone drunks. We call them phoners at my home group. You're a phoner, right? Yeah. And I don't know. We get in blackouts, and we tend to want to talk on the phone. And I remember in my drunken stupor driving on the freeway and seeing a call box and saying, I'm going to make a phone call. And the next thing I know, man, I just plowed my car right into that call box. Steam is shooting up. And 30 days later, I'm standing in front of a woman judge with a second felony DUI. And she's looking at my rap sheet, and she said, Tammy, your rich doctor husband isn't going to buy you out of this one this time. You are going to do some time. However, I will waive the first 30 days of your jail sentence if you're willing to go into a lockdown unit. And I didn't mention this earlier, but by the time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had been in 4 lockdown units from the age of 15 to the age of 31 when I came here, and never once were they for the diagnosis of alcoholism. It was always mental and emotional disorders, trauma due to childhood, post-traumatic stress syndrome, and over the years I started gathering more like bipolar syndrome and all that stuff. And they always treated the symptoms of alcoholism. I'm depressed, take an antidepressant. I have anxiety, take a pill for anxiety. I can't sleep at night, here's something to sleep. But nothing ever got better. And this woman told me that she was going to put me in a lockdown facility, and it wasn't because I had emotional and mental disorders, and it wasn't because of trauma due to my childhood. It's because I had hit 2 people under the influence of alcohol, and she said I appeared to have a strange and abnormal reaction to alcohol, and she put me in a lockdown unit, and the focus was on my drinking. And I got in there, and I told those doctors what I had been telling them since I was 15 years old and I first started appearing at those places. Look, I drink alcohol, and I seem to have these, you know, strange reactions. And the doctor said that I was drinking to self-medicate because I was working through my childhood issues in therapy about the things that had happened with my dad. And my drinking was just really my way of self-medicating. And if they could get a combination of the right medications, I wouldn't need to drink. But the important thing was none of this was my fault. Later, when I came to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, these crusty old-timers had a new name for the effect that alcohol had on me. You suggested that I may be alcoholic. In that lockdown unit, I told those doctors that I'd wake up in the morning out of a blackout, go downstairs. I'd see broken children, a broken husband, a broken home, and broken dreams. I'd go back upstairs, turn the heating blanket up to Mom, take a drink, and think of ways to kill myself. And they told me that I had clinical depression as a result of my childhood. And the best hope they had for me was medical management through psychotropic drugs and being institutionalized for episodic depression throughout my life. But the important thing that I needed to know, none of this was my fault. Later, when I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, These old timers had a new name for a mother that was willing to take her own life without giving a flying hoot how it would affect those two children. You called it alcoholism, selfishness, and self-centeredness. The world revolved around my childhood pain. Forget that my kids are in their childhood. It was all about me and my pain. I told those doctors that my husband, working the hours that he worked, I used to take money out of his wallet. And on my swearing off periods, I'd go down to the local health club and work out with all the men, of course. And then we'd go up to the pub after, and I'd play big shot with his money and buy everybody lunch and drinks on his dime, always playing the big shot, always taking credit for things I didn't earn. I want you to know that I've worked the 13 of the 15, 16 years I've been sober. Never once since I've earned my own paycheck have I ever bought a room full of people lunch on my dime. And they told me that being that I had been put in three at that point, foster homes as a kid, that my taking my husband's money was really my way of buying back that self-esteem that I had so poorly lost in that childhood. And really, none of this was my fault. Later, when I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, you old-timers had a real fancy name for that. You called it stealing. And not only did I steal my husband's money and play big shot on his dime, but as a wife and a mother of two kids, I used to take men to some pretty seedy hotels, and I did the things that drunken women do in those hotels. And in therapy, they told me that I was searching for the love of a father that I never had as a kid in those men in those hotels. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, you had a real fancy name for that, too. You called it cheating. By the time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, my husband and my mother had paid close to $100,000 in expensive therapists to find out that I was just a damaged little girl and a victim of circumstance. And for a buck in a basket, these old-timers said, "No, babe, you're a liar, you're a cheat, you're a thief, and you're probably just a garden-variety alcoholic suffering from alcoholism." And it's the first time I heard the truth in 31 years. You know, and if you're not making it in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's not my opinion. The girls that I sponsor always say, "How come I got drunk?" And I tell them, just read the first page of Chapter 5. It's not my opinion. The book tells you. Those who do not recover, it first says that they are not willing to completely give themselves to this simple program. Not partially, not temporarily, not till I get my life in order. But then it goes on to say, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. And 16 years ago, I was constitutionally incapable of being honest with myself. And I'd like to thank all you old-timers who don't want to be the popular sponsor and this, this, and that, but you're just willing to tell us the truth in the name of our lives. And I don't remember any pats on the back here, but I sure remember all this hard truths. And the book tells us that we need to swallow some hard truths about ourselves. And I am really grateful to those of you that have put me up against the wall and tell me those truths that I need to hear, because you cared more about my life than you did about being popular. And for that, I'll always thank our old timers. So I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, a condition of my getting out of that rehab, and I'm wearing low-cut tops and little Daisy Duke shorts, and needless to say, I spent most of my time out in the parking lot flirting with the AA BIM boys. Those are the guys out there that like to pick up on the newcomer women. Don't feel bad, guys. We have AA bimbos, too. And needless to say, I took 5 of those 30-day chips, and I'll never forget. Well, I do forget my last drink because I'm a blackout drunk, but I'll never forget my last surrender, because I stood at a podium and I took my 5th 30-day chip, and I told you all about how wonderful my life was and about God. But what I didn't tell you is Al-Anon had rightly convinced my husband to remove his children from the mother that was in and out of rehabs, in and out of therapy, and in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous and could not stay sober. And he had moved my children into a 1-bedroom hotel room, working the hours that he worked, and just left me in the 5-bedroom house because it was just too much of a hassle to evict me. And I hadn't seen my husband or kids in 67 days. And I didn't tell you that. And I went outside with my 5th 30-day chip, you know, attached to the other 4, like, you know, this was something to be proud of, bangling in the wind. And I went to pick up on the AA BIM boys, and this mean old-timer, Cowboy Nick, came out, and he said, "Kid, you have a phone call." And I went back into the clubhouse, and I picked up the phone, and it was my husband, Rick, and he said, "Tammy, are you sober?" And with the arrogance of an alcoholic, I said, "Yes, Rick, I'm sober. In fact, I have just taken another 30-day chip." And he said, "Well, Our son's playing T-ball on today's his first game. And if you are sober, the kids want to know if you would come and watch his game. And I got the directions, and I drove out to this little league field. And I'm walking toward the field, and all of a sudden I look up, and my husband is out on the field with a team uniform with another man from Al-Anon, and he was the assistant coach of our son's team. And my little five-year-old son was up at bat, and there was this huge cone with a red ball on it, and he's swinging, trying to hit the ball off the cone, and my little boy was so tiny that his little helmet, batting helmet, kept falling over his eyes. And my little daughter, Chelsea, was standing on the chain link fence in a little sundress, and the women from Al-Anon helped my husband do her hair. And I just realized that my family was going on with their lives without me, and that my alcoholism wasn't affecting them anymore. And I did the only thing an alcoholic knows how to do when they feel that fear. And I walked away from my family that day, and I saw a guy with a cooler full of beer. And I said, "Man, you look like you're feeling good." And he said, "Yeah, babe, nothing a beer wouldn't cure. You want one?" 4 lockdown units, 5 30-day trips, $100,000 in therapy. My kids are living in a one-bedroom hotel room, and I said yes. And I don't know what that dude's night was like, but I came to 3 days later down in Inglewood, which is almost an hour away from where I live. And to this day, I don't recall anything that happened in those 3 days in that blackout drinking that I had done. But I remember sitting in this woman's kitchen, and she had my backpack. She had found me in an alley behind her house when she took her trash out. And she's on the phone with my ID, giving my husband, Rick, directions to come and pick me up one more time. And Rick came out to Inglewood, and he handed me a manila envelope. And he said, "Tammy, this is a restraining order. Your mother and I have received full custody of the kids. I've moved back into our home on this last 3-day run of yours. You are not to come within 1,700 feet of me, of my business, of our home, of the kids, or of their school, and you got to go." And he didn't say another word. And the whole ride home, it was like the longest ride of my life. And he turned off the engine in front of our house, and he said, "Tammy, you have 5 minutes to just pack up some stuff, go find a place to live, and I will send you money and your stuff later." And I said, "Rick, where am I going to go?" And he said, "I don't know, Tammy. Why don't you call one of your AA BIM boys to come and pick you up?" And I called an AA BIM boy who was at the hole in the sky, and he said he'd come and get me. And I walked upstairs, and I threw some T-shirts and some sweats into a brown paper bag, and I literally was spiritually dead. I felt nothing. I just remember this, like, ringing in my ears. And I walked downstairs, and I said to my husband, "Could I please just say goodbye to my kids before I go?" And I knew I had to go. I wanted to go. I knew I was destroying everything that came near me. And he said, "Tammy, your mom and I have called every Morgan hospital in the greater Los Angeles area on these last 3 days. Those children have been through hell and back. Don't you dare wake them." And I walked into my little five-year-old son's room that night, and my little boy looked so alive and so innocent and so little to me. And I just walked up to him, and I reeked of alcohol. I had puked. I hadn't bathed in 3 days. And I just remember touching his little heart-shaped lips while he was asleep, and he opened up his eyes, and he started to stroke the inside of my arm. That's what he used to do when I would read stories to him. And he said, "Mommy, why are you doing this to us?" And in that instant, I became willing to be willing to do whatever it took. I never wanted to drink alcohol again. And I hit my son's floor that night, and this is not some esoteric BS story from the podium. I grabbed my arms, and I said 3 words that I believe every alcoholic needs to say for themselves. Not for their sponsor, not for their mommy, not for their daddy, not for their husband, for themselves, before they surrender to this sucker. And I said, "God, help me." And for me, it was like a megaphone from the heavens. I heard something in my son's room that I must have heard those 5 months that I came flitting in and out of here with my low-cut tops and my shorts flirting with you men. Rarely do we see a person fail who thoroughly follows our path. And I knew I could do it. You old-timers that have all walked before me, I got 3 rows of you right here. You had responsibly carried a message of Alcoholics Anonymous to a drunken mother, and I was filled with hope that night. And I went down to my clubhouse that night. The AA BIM boy picked me up, and here I am, a surgeon's wife, with a 5-bedroom house and a full-time maid and 4 cars in the garage paid for. And I slept in the back of a van behind my home group that night, and I never felt more at peace than I did that night, because I didn't have to quit drinking one more time. I was finished. I never wanted to drink alcohol again. And the next morning, that mean old timer, Cowboy Nick, opened up the hole in the sky, and I came crawling out of the van, and I said, Nick, I don't ever want to drink alcohol again. And he hugged me, and he said, welcome home, kid. And I haven't had a drink since. You know, in that, I don't know, I've been listening to a lot of the speakers, and you guys had nicer old-timers than I did, because these guys were rough. Man, I mean, they made me dress like a lady, and I had to stop cussing and all that. And in my first year of sobriety, through the grace of God and Al-Anon, I received custody back of my children, and I didn't think that was going to happen for years. And my Al-Anon husband decided to come home and give his sober wife in Alcoholics Anonymous a chance to be a sober mom. And I'll tell you, the mommy bug bit me. And I remember at 1 year of sobriety, I turned to my old-timers and I said, I'm going back to school, and I've just signed up for 17 units. And they said, good kid, now go drop 11 of them. And and I finished that bachelor's degree 6 units at a time because these old goats told me that I will never make my life so busy that I cannot be a daily member in this program of recovery. It took me 14 years, but I finished a master's degree. And actually, as I'm standing here today, I'm signed up for a second master's degree, and I don't come from college-educated kind of folk. And I had to do it the slow way, and I'm grateful for that because I've seen a lot of the girls I sponsor not take that advice, and they get so busy out there with their jobs and school, and the next thing they come back raising their hands. I lost my legal right to raise my own 2 children because of a clear liquid that looked just like this water in a glass. And today I'm an 8th grade school teacher. I teach your kids. I teach your grandkids. And if that doesn't scare you, it should. you know, that biological father that I had, they told me in Alcoholics Anonymous that if I always focus on the negative, I have a huge no vacancy sign up for the good things in my life. And our speaker last night alluded to that. And I remember I was sitting with my daughter at the orthodontist office, and she was 12, and I was stroking her hair, and she was getting braces. And she said, Mommy, you have a really pretty smile. Are my teeth going to be straight like yours? Did you have braces? And all of a sudden, I remembered that biological father that I had that had a problem touching his 2 daughters had worked 2 jobs to put braces on my sister and my teeth because he had really crooked teeth. I have no pictures of my father smiling, and when he did smile, he would always cover my mouth. And in his own little way, he had worked 2 jobs to make sure that my sister and I didn't have to go through that. And all of a sudden, I realized that I had fallen from grace, that I had hurt my children and broken their hearts. But I had a place to come to where I could raise my hand and say, my name's Tammy, and I'm hurting my kids. And you people said, welcome. And my dad never had a place to go where he could raise his hand and say, I'm Ron, and I can't stop touching my daughters, and I need help. And the forgiveness came that day, and I understood how grateful I am that there was a program of recovery for my affliction. And I felt this love for my dad, and that's never gone away. That stepfather that came into our life and tried to put structure and discipline in my life, no budding alcoholic wants that, so I ran away from home. You know, he passed away a week ago, and I was a big girl, and I helped my mom bury my dad. And I called UCLA because my daughter just graduated last weekend because I didn't get the quarterly tuition. And I said, I haven't received the bill for her tuition, and they said that Torben Elgard had paid for it. And my dad on his deathbed paid off my daughter's entire tuition. And we don't come from college-educated kind of folk. And at 12 years of sobriety, that husband of mine quit going to Al-Anon meetings. And he forgot he was an Al-Anon. And about a year later, he came home and said, Tammy, I'm leaving you for another woman. She's younger than you, she's prettier than you, and she's more fun than you. And I thought I was going to die. And he and I used to do split pitches all over, and my ego couldn't handle telling you all that I failed as a wife. 3 months later, my beautiful 15-year-old son fell so hard to addiction that after 3 hospitals, 2 lockdown units, I had to have him kidnapped in the middle of the night and taken to Utah for a year to save his life. And I was so embarrassed to tell you guys that I've now failed as a mother. And that mean old-timer, Cowboy Nick, that took me through the 12 steps and the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous and helped me to become a lady and a mother, died of a stroke, and within 3 months, I lost my three best guys, my husband, my son, and my old-timer. And I wish I could tell you that because I had a good foundation, I just dove into the book, and I dove into love and service, and I did what I was supposed to do. But I walked upstairs, turned the heating blanket up to Mom, sucked my thumb, and thought of ways to kill myself. And my newcomer babies all called me up and said, poor you, poor you, you're a pretty woman, you were a good wife, you're a victim, none of this is your fault. And then came the old-timers. And this time, it was my boyfriend, Patrick. And at that time, he wasn't my boyfriend, but he walked in and he said, for God's sakes, Tammy, you are not the first woman to have been left an Alcoholics Anonymous, nor will you be the last. And you're not the first one of us that has had a drug-addicted child, nor will you be the last. And you are not the first one of us to have to bury a beloved sponsor, nor will you be the last. Now get up out of this bed, quit sucking your thumb, and act like the sober woman you taught me to be. Your problem is not your drug-addicted son. Your problem is not your cheating husband. And your problem is not your dead old-timer. Your problem is alcoholism. Selfishness and self-centeredness, the world again revolves around your pain. And for God's sakes, your kids are going through this divorce too. Now be the mother that they deserve. And I fell in love. And in reality, Patrick was going through a painful divorce, too. And we patted each other on the back and said, don't drink, you won't get drunk. And we went to a whole lot of meetings, and we're a boy meets girl on AA campus. And we've been together 3 years now. You know, last Saturday, my little 22-year-old daughter graduated UCLA with honors. And you told me that great events would come to pass, not only for me, but for countless others. I watched my little daughter graduate, and she doesn't have tattoos, and she's not all pierced out, and she doesn't cuss like a drunken sailor, and she doesn't pass her body around in order to be accepted. She's a beautiful, intelligent, feminine, articulate little girl. And old-timers that I gave you hell for the cussing, now I understand why you asked me to dress like a lady, because I was raising a little girl. The following day, I was able to go watch my mentor, Bob Lemke, with 45 years of sobriety, marry his beautiful bride. And I'll tell you, man, if you two don't make it, we're all screwed. And what an honor that was. My son is still struggling with addiction, but through the grace of God and Al-Anon, I finally went to the enemy camp. And my sponsor gave me the best advice. She said, girl, you go in there, and I don't care if they recognize you as a sponsor, as a speaker. Don't you allude to, mention, or in any way let them know that you're a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You go in there, yeah, you go in there as a broken mom with a broken heart. And I did, and they honored that. And I'm doing better. He's struggling, but I'm doing better. I can never replay Alcoholics Anonymous, which you people have given to me, but I'm going to go down trying. Today when I feel that fear in that book, Alcoholics Anonymous, I have a mighty powerful God that I pray to for strength. I have friends like Bob and Marilyn and Fish over there and his wife that I can call and just talk those dumb alcoholic fears through with. I thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. And more importantly, I thank each and every one of you and Alcoholics Anonymous for God. Thanks for listening.
We would like to thank our speaker, Tammy, and all those who... Wow. And all those who read. Janelle for the statement of anonymity, Lois for Chapter 5, and Chris for the 12 Traditions. And now we will have Jerry make special announcements and close the meeting.
Well, good morning, everyone. My name is Jerry, and I am an alcoholic. Hi, Jerry. Has this been a great roundup or what?